The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
These are the sounds of crushed souls. The sounds of despair from former radio personalities languishing in the purgatory of corporate consolidation. These former radio personalities have lost their livelihoods, not because they weren't entertaining or informative, but because they don't meet today's corporate terrestrial broadcast standards of being smelly, overweight douchebags, seething with vein-popping hatred. These radio refugees and their audiences have since migrated to the internet, but their struggle continues as the quest for monetization ensues. Nicole Sandler is leading the way to reestablishing thought-provoking and entertaining radio. And you can help by clicking the donate button on NicoleSandler.com. Donate today, or as much and as often as you can. Dry the tears of listeners by removing the rotting stench of corporate radio. Won't you help?
Look for the false equivalency when talking to your devotees. Compare yourself to others with some lies. I mean a false equivalency should be your favorite recipe to make it seem as if you're justified. When you're indicted 97 times, just accuse some others of similar crimes. If you find Biden and Mike Pence had secret files, there's your defense. But just don't mention that they complied while you tried to hide files that were classified and maybe sold a few. That false equivalence is sure to work for you. It works for you. Look for a false equivalency when talking to your devotees. Compare yourself to others with some lies. I mean a false equivalency might help prevent a guilty plea from co-defendants that you terrorize. Now when you find a laptop from the president's son, use it as a backstop for the crimes you've done. Investigate Biden for crimes you invent. No need for a trial, just cause dissent. It doesn't have to make much sense. Just buy some time for your own defense. Have I given you a clue? The false equivalence is sure to work for you till your next coup.
Gerald there. He does these song parodies and does them really well. So that was an appropriate one to begin today's show with because the hearing that happened this morning. Now, granted, I'm a little brain dead. I had a late night last night. Springsteen rocked Phoenix. It was such a great show. We had horrible seats. Worst seats I've ever had for a Springsteen show or for any concert in the last, 30 years for that matter. But you know what? It's okay because we were in the building and it was awesome. And I really think, look, Springsteen was in fine form, sounded great. I mean, his voice was in perfect form. I got off to a little rocky start, but oh my goodness, throughout he was just on. The band was on. Jake Clemens, sorry, we'll get to the meat of it. I just have to get this out. Jake Clemens, who became the saxophonist for the E Street Band after his uncle, Clarence Clemens, died. I always thought, oh, it's so nice that Bruce brought him along and is, sort of taking him under his wing. And he was always decent. But I'll tell you something. I don't know what he did. He must have increased his lung capacity or something. He was on fire last night. He's got all the Clarence parts down pat and then some. Oh, my God. So great show. A couple of little treats, a little bit of song changes from the first leg of the tour that was delayed for almost a year because he got sick. But it was great. It was just awesome. If you have the chance to see Springsteen with the E Street Band, I say take it because, frankly, I don't know that he's going to mount a tour like this again. He's 74 years old now. As I said, still going strong. The band sounded amazing. And if you follow me, if you're a Facebook friend of mine, I posted a bunch of little video clips. It's the least I could do to share. If you're not a Facebook friend, but you want to be, I had to make my account private because of all the anti-Semitic attacks, basically, that have been coming lately. Send me a friend request. Just say you're a listener and I told you to write the note and I will approve your friendship. Anyway, Civic Folly in the chat room said, Bruce is the one that has seated people who couldn't afford good tickets to the front row, right? What they do, and they didn't come and get me, but notoriously at Bruce shows, he sends people out to the worst seats in the house and brings them down front. At every show, he does this. I don't know how many people, but we weren't among them. Ours weren't the worst seats in the house, but they were pretty damn close. All right. You want more, Bruce? Talk to me another time. We got a busy show today. So the title of today's show is the title of this new book, Fighting Mad. The subtitle is Resisting the End of Roe v. Wade. And it's an essay. It's a collection of essays. Book just hit the stores yesterday. Couldn't be more timely or topical. And we will speak with Crystal Littlejohn in just a little while. She'll join us. So we'll get to that. But the Fighting Mad moniker also works for this morning's hearing. Yes, it was another hearing of the Kangaroo Court, also known as the impeachment inquiry into President Joe Biden, which is only being undertaken because of, hold on, I'm looking for a specific clip that I thought I saved this morning. Well, some I've got on video, some I guess I just have audio. So we'll start with audio. So this is the Oversight Committee, chaired by James Comer, who is a certifiable moron. He's just horrible, just brainless idiot. And then the ranking member is friend of the show now, Jamie Raskin, and this is part of his opening.
With any luck, today marks the end of perhaps the most spectacular failure in the history of congressional investigations. The effort to find a high crime or misdemeanor committed by Joe Biden and then to impeach him for it. In prior hilarious episodes of this long-running madcap series, America got to see the following. One, nearly 20 fact witnesses who could not identify a single act of wrongdoing by President Biden, much less a high crime and misdemeanor, and who overwhelmingly testified that Biden was not involved in any of his family's business adventures. Two, three expert witnesses called by the majority itself who said nothing that they had seen in the tens of thousands of pages of documents adduced by the majority even remotely approached the level of a high crime and misdemeanor. Well, bank records would show exactly what all the witnesses told us, that Joe Biden was not involved in his family members' businesses.
Nope.
Repeated voyeuristic displays of pornographic images by the majority, completely irrelevant to any conceivable legislative or investigative purpose. A star witness, Gal Luft, who turned out to be a Chinese agent and an illegal arms trafficker on the run from American justice. And the key piece of evidence, which launched the entire zany goose chase, an FD 1023 form in which the FBI duly recorded a completely fictional tip about a $5 million bribe to Vice President Biden peddled by Alex Smirnoff, who has been criminally indicted by a Trump-appointed U.S. attorney, Special Counsel David Weiss, for felony counts of systematically lying to the FBI and constructing a false record about Joe Biden, and now sits in jail in California as a flight risk while the world studies his longstanding and extensive ties to Russian intelligence. Today, the good chairman and his ace MAGA detectives have finally jumped the shark. The comedy of errors comes crashing to an end as House Republicans in more than a dozen Biden districts beg for mercy, and the committee throws a flabby Hail Mary pass 3 weeks after the Super Bowl's over. So today, we revisit the fruitless testimony of two more fading star witnesses who have failed to testify to any presidential wrongdoing, much less
Look
evidence of high crimes and misdemeanors.
So, Jamie Raskin, just a portion of his opening remarks as the ranking member on the Oversight Committee. But the Democrats had little patience. You know, there's a guy who, if you listen on Fridays when Marcy Wheeler is here, you've no doubt heard us talk about Tony Bobulinski. You heard Cassidy Hutchinson talk about Tony Bobulinski. Tony Bobulinski is a former business associate of Hunter Biden's, who then jumped the shark and you know, started palling around with Donald Trump. Well, he got up. He was like their key witness this morning. And he got up to testify. I'll play you just a few seconds of it so you could hear how contentious and how full of shit he was.
He started his opening statement. Let's listen to him.
To hear the truth. Though the truth involving the deep corruption of the Biden family, including the malfeasance of the sitting president of the United States, might be raw and unpleasant, the American people must hear it. You're presented here today with two narratives in this investigation. A false one being pushed by Joe Biden, a serial liar and fabulous.
Okay, see, and enough of that. So I'm going to turn you off and go. Instead, I'm going to bring you AOC's questioning of Mr. Bobulinski. And she was not taking any of his shit.
Mr. Bobulinski, I heard your opening statement. It's submitted to the record, part of our proceedings. I have a quick question.
Yeah.
Simple.
Yeah.
Is it your testimony today that you personally witnessed President Joe Biden commit a crime?
I believe the fact that he was sitting with me while I was putting together a
business
deal.
Did you witness the president commit a crime? Is it your testimony today?
Yes.
And what crime?
What was that?
Have you witnessed?
How much time do I have to go through it?
It is simple. You name the crime. Did you watch him steal something?
No.
Corruption statutes, RICO and conspiracy.
What is it? What is the crime, sir?
You
specifically.
Specifically.
You asked me to answer the question. I answered the question.
No.
RICO, you're obviously not familiar with. Corruption
Excuse
statute.
Me, sir. Excuse me, sir. Excuse me, sir. RICO is not a crime. It is a category. What is the
crime? Category of crimes that you're then charged
You
under
have charges.
A long hundred
You have charges. Statute. Sir, please
you want me to
name
the exact statute under RICO?
Yes.
Well, it's funny. In this committee room, everyone's not here. There's over 18
All right, sir. I reclaim my
lawyers that
I
went to law school.
Time. I
I'll
reclaim
leave it
my
up
time.
To you guys
okay,
to
thank
define
you,
the
sir.
Statute
I reclaim my time.
RICO.
Clearly, what we are seeing here today is a continuation of the 15-month saga of the Republican majority lost in the desert.
Yep.
Impeachment 101.
Yep.
The majority party or whomever is raising impeachment must accuse the president of a high crime,
Hello.
A specific high crime or misdemeanor. I would like to submit to the record HRES 918, the House resolution to open this impeachment inquiry.
Without objection to order.
This resolution does not outline a high crime or misdemeanor. It's not here.
Nope.
Now, when we compare the chairman's opening from his previous opening, he's talking about Ukraine and Burisma and all of this. It is this entire inquiry is based on a blockbuster piece of information that was in a classified SCIF room.
Yep.
And inside that room was a document alleging President Biden directly of a $10 million bribery scheme. A $10 million bribery scheme. Extremely serious. What happened? What happened a month ago, Mr. Chairman? That document, the FBI arrested the person who offered those allegations for falsifying his testimony to the FBI.
Yes.
This entire impeachment inquiry is based on an actual provable individual who has lied.
Yep.
Now, responsible leadership would withdraw an inquiry based on that.
Yep.
Withdraw it.
Yep.
Instead, what we are seeing is that this committee was warned about the falsehoods of these allegations long before that, warned by Trump's Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, and yet they proceeded anyway. The chairman proceeded anyway. This committee was warned by Rudy Giuliani associate right here, Lev Parnas, after that document about the falsehoods of this.
Mm-hmm.
Then held hearings where your own expert witnesses said that there was no grounds for impeachment, and you proceeded anyway. And finally, as if none of this was enough, the FBI arrested the individual who was the source of the entire, heart of the matter, to launch this impeachment inquiry, and proceeded anyway. At this point, the story is not the fact that the basis of this impeachment inquiry is wrong. The story is why it's proceeding anyway.
Damn straight.
Why is this committee proceeding based on false charges? And if there, and by the way, no charges. I have yet to hear in the chairman's opening the allegation that they are specifically charging the president of the United States with.
Yeah.
I'm hearing about Biden family.
Yep.
I'm hearing about this and that. I am not hearing the specific allegation by this committee. What is it? It's not here. And that is the problem.
Hello.
The story is when this committee knew that they were working with falsified evidence. That's the story.
That is the story.
And with that, I yield back.
You go, AOC. So that was AOC taking no shit from Bobulinski or Comer or anyone else. Let me, I got to play another one for you, because another member of Congress who I love, she's one of my new favorites, is Jasmine Crockett from Texas. And Bobulinski, you already saw what you didn't see, because I didn't play it, was his opening statement in which he called everybody a liar. Everybody from President Biden to Hunter Biden to Jamie Raskin to you name it. He called everyone a liar. Jamie Raskin made it a point to ask if the rules allow that, because they don't allow a member to say it. But I guess there's no such rule about a witness saying it. Here, Jasmine Crockett. Well, it doesn't exactly ask Tony Bobulinski a question, and she lets him know that she hasn't quite asked him a question and to kindly shut the fuck up like this.
Okay, and is it the LLC that your attorney works for?
I believe so, yes.
You believe so, okay. So at this point in time, I'd ask unanimous consent to enter into the record a document indicating that the law firm representing Tony Bobulinski was paid $10,000 as recently as January of this year by the Save America PAC, which you may recognize as Donald Trump's PAC.
Without objection.
Thank you. Now, so far in this hearing, it has felt like the worst episode of The Apprentice. I'm sure you're familiar with that show. It seems like my colleagues and maybe you and some others are trying to become the next vice president of the United States of America. You're auditioning or something like that, because, Mr. Bobulinski, I know that you take exception to the fact that your credibility has been called into question over and over. But when someone comes to testify under oath, whether it's before this committee, behind closed doors, or in person, then we have to evaluate someone's credibility.
Mm-hmm.
And, sir, I definitely have always had issues with your credibility, as I know that you are very well aware of. So let me remind you of what happened behind closed doors.
Well, you should ask Ro Khanna about my credibility.
I haven't asked you a question.
Okay.
You are?
When I haven't. So when I ask you a question, that's when you answer. Otherwise, I'm talking.
Boom.
So,
excuse me?
With my time, because it's
my
time, I want to be clear that when we were behind closed doors, you called a number of people liars. You called the Wall Street Journal liars.
Mm-hmm.
You called Cassidy Hutchison a liar. You called the FBI a liar. You called Rob Walker a liar. You called James Gillier a liar. You called Hunter Biden a liar. You called Jim Biden a liar. And just today, you added to your list, you called my colleague, Congressman Mr. Goldman, a liar as well. It seems like, according to you, the only person that's telling the truth is you, and everyone else is lying. But I want to move on to something else.
Is that a question?
It's or? Not no. a question.
Okay.
You'll know when I ask you a question, I promise.
Thank you.
So.
I love her. You'll know when I ask you a question. That wasn't what. You go, girl. Somebody else. So we know a lot of us have names for the former guy. You know, the former guy, the Orange Menace, Twitler, all kinds of names. In fact, Jonathan Larson, who's the fucking news guy who will be back on Monday, has a long paragraph. You know, there are a lot of qualifiers. The failed twice impeached, 91 times, 91 criminally charged, four times indicted, you know, Orange Menace, whatever you want to call him. Chantel Brown, who hasn't made much noise yet in this Congress, is a freshman congresswoman from Ohio. I just want to play for you her description of Trump because it was perfect. Here we
go. It is the bondless, broke bluffer, twice impeached, four times indicted, insurrection initiator, election denying,
right.
Self-declared dictator on day one, and puppet for Putin. The one who wants to terminate the Constitution and defund the FBI.
Yep.
The one who romanticized exchanging of love letters with North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un. Yep. The one who just last week embraced autocrat Orban of Hungary to discuss their diabolical plans to destroy our democracy.
Oh, that one.
The one who proposed a policy to ban Muslims from this country.
Oh, yeah, him.
The one who just this week said any Jewish person who votes for a Democrat hates their religion and Israel.
Yeah,
the one
did.
Who called neo-Nazis carrying tiki torches chanting Jews will not replace us, good people.
Yeah.
The one who referred to African nations as, I quote, shithole countries. The one who called NFL players, the majority whom are black, sons of bitches for taking a knee in protest of the ever-present racial inequality and police brutality that continues to pervade our justice system. The one who called Mexicans rapists and promised to build a wall and have them pay for it, and in case you missed it, it didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
The one who told women of color from the born in the United States, elected to Congress and serving on this very committee, to go back to their own countries.
Yep.
The one who bragged about grabbing women by their private parts.
Mm-hmm.
The one who confused his rape victim, whom he claimed was not his type, for his very own ex-wife. The one who is an admitted and committed adulterer, who attempted to pay off a porn star for her silence.
Uh-huh.
The one who has publicly mocked people with disabilities.
Yeah.
The one who dodged the draft and referred to prisoners of war as losers, the very people who pay a high price so we could enjoy the freedoms that far too many of us take for granted. The one who boasted about being able to stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue to shoot someone and not lose votes.
And she keeps going. It just got cut off there, but she keeps going. I don't know if the whole thing was her introduction of the former guy, the Orange Menace, Twitler, whatever you want to call him. But you go, girl. That was pretty awesome. There's more. Maybe later or tomorrow we'll get to more of it. This impeachment inquiry, as AOC just said, as I played for you, is a sham. It is opposite world. And we have a lot of really important issues to deal with. So I see our guest is here and I'm really excited. Before I bring on Krista Littlejohn, and we're going to talk about the new book that she co-edited called Fighting Mad, Resisting the End of Roe v. Wade. I want to play for you a quick clip recorded Sunday. Now, a lot of you have heard this already because on Monday I came in and played the entire 30 minutes of Jamie Raskin's comments when he came here to the Phoenix area. He was in Tempe, and he spoke to a group of organizers, the Democrats of Maricopa County. But the one little section, and he was on fire. Jamie Raskin is just brilliant. But this is just a few seconds of what he said regarding what has happened to, what has been done to women by the former guy, the one that Chantel Brown just partially described.
I got to see Joe Biden violate one taboo that I'm really glad he violated. He stared them in the face and he told the truth to the Supreme Court.
Woo-hoo!
He stared them in the face. when they overthrew more than a half century of precedent to destroy Roe versus Wade, which was what Donald Trump sent them to do, and which Donald Trump is running around the country bragging about having done. When they did that, they said along the way, well, we can leave it up to the states. Women are not without political or electoral power. That was the line Joe Biden quoted to them. He said, you're about to see how much political and electoral power.
You are about to see how much political power women have. I'm very happy to welcome Krystal Littlejohn to the show. She is the Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Oregon. She's author of Just Get on the Pill, The Uneven Burden of Reproductive Politics. And her new book, edited with Ricky Solinger, Fighting Mad, Resisting the End of Roe v. Wade, just hit shelves yesterday. Krystal, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for being here today. Oh, and I have no audio from you. Uh-oh.
No, I'm okay. I think that should be better. Okay. Yep. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. So this is one of your subjects. You've written a lot about women's reproductive rights, or as you refer to it in the book, what, reproductive autonomy? Reproductive autonomy. You seem to be much younger than I am. I was a kid in 1973 when Roe v. Wade became law. So I've never known. I vaguely remember I was like 12 years old when it happened. But you must have grown up in a world, in a country where it was never questioned. Women had control over their medical control of their body. And now all of a sudden it's taken away from us. This is a sea change in American life.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that's been really important for me in the research that I do is showing how even when Roe v. Wade was the law of the land, so many people struggled to be able to get the reproductive health care that they needed, to be able to get the abortion care that they needed. And so Ricky and I worked on this book, Fighting Mad, to talk about access issues with abortion. But in the work that I'd done previously, my work had also shown that even when Roe was the law of the land, young women that I interviewed had trouble accessing abortion. And so what we really wanted to show with the book is to demonstrate in some ways, as that clip was just talking about, that even as there are these assaults that are taking place on abortion, even as politicians try and limit people's access to reproductive freedom and autonomy, there are always going to be people that are fighting for them and that are fighting to make sure that they have access to the services that they need and to their abortion rights, which is a human right that they deserve.
Should any man ever tell a woman what she should or shouldn't have rights to do with her own body?
I don't think anybody should be able to tell any woman or person who can get pregnant that they don't have particular rights to their body, right? I think that is fundamentally a part of their right to reproductive justice, to be able to determine what they're going to do with their pregnancies. And what we see happening is an assault on that. And we're also seeing the devastating consequences that are taking place because of what's been done via the Dobbs decision.
So now, Krystal, you've written books on your own. This one you and Ricky Solinger edited. So it's a collection of essays. Tell us who's in it. Tell us about the book. Tell us why my listeners do want to read it.
So this book is one of the most rewarding books that I have ever worked on, because we gather essays from over 50 contributors that are really grappling with abortion access and fighting for abortion access across domains. They're activists, they're legislators, they're educators, they're healthcare professionals, right? We have so many people that are demonstrating how urgent it is to fight for abortion rights in light of the assault that has been taking place, and showing us really how to do that. I think in this day and age, so many people feel confused about what to do. Some people feel helpless, some people feel hopeless. And the book really shows us that even amid all of the stuff going on, there are people that are out there really doing their best to try and make sure that people that are being prevented from accessing abortion can get as much information, as many resources, as much support as they possibly can get so that they can realize their right to abortion access, which has been made so much more difficult by everything that's taken place since Dobbs.
Yeah. You know, again, I go back to my teenage years. I grew up in South Florida, and I went to Hollywood Hills High School, and right across Sterling Road, right across from the school, there was a Planned Parenthood. Well, I went there when I turned 16 to get on the pill. Didn't need my parents' permission. I was able to go and get the help. I have friends, not many, but a couple, who went there to get abortions because they were kids in high school. And the fact that that choice was available to them, I'm grateful I never had to avail myself of it, but knowing that it was there. And now I've left Florida for somewhat obvious reasons. My husband jokes we're allergic to the fascism. You know, my daughter is there and she's 24, and it frightens me that if something should happen and she winds up pregnant, she has no recourse in that state because of what's going on there. And I think about, I was in high school. It had never been an issue. Now, yes, we do have to fight as women. We have to fight for everything, it seems, but that was settled law. And we saw these Supreme Court justices, extreme court justices, as I call them now, lie in their confirmation hearing saying settled law, settled law. This was always the goal. But I'm looking at your book, and part one starts with Roe was never enough. And it begins with an introduction that you wrote. And Roe was never enough because Roe did not say abortion is legal, that women have reproductive autonomy, right? It was about privacy. It did not codify into law our right to control our own bodies. Is that what you're saying when you say Roe was never enough?
That's a fantastic question. And what we're really saying in Roe is it was never enough is in part that even when Roe was the law of the land, people still face barriers to abortion access. And so we have contributors that talk about, for example, experiences of incarcerated women and people who can get pregnant, who even when they had a constitutional right to abortion, might still face access to being able to get an abortion when they were incarcerated because of different jail policies. Practices that limited their access to that, and that sometimes made them believe that they didn't actually have access to it when they in fact did. We also know about the Hyde Amendment, right, which prevented the use of federal Medicaid funds for abortion, except in cases when the life of the pregnant person would be endangered by carrying a pregnancy to term. And so we know that even when people believed that everything was okay under Roe, that there are many people that were suffering, many people that were struggling to get access. And what Fighting Mad shows is people are fighting today, you know, since the Dobbs decision to protect abortion access or allow people to get abortion access. As you're saying, people in Florida, right? People in states where abortion is banned, right? Trying to fight for them to be able to give them resources so they can travel, trying to make sure they have information so they understand what happens if they have to get an abortion. What do they do? What kinds of things might they have to worry about with criminalization, with all of the mis and disinformation that's out there, and also just the true legal landscape that they might face. And so we know that people are fighting for that, but with Roe was never enough, we also know that even before the Dobbs decision, people had to fight to make sure that the patchwork network of access to abortion was doing as much as it could because it still wasn't enough. And even though the Dobbs decision has been horrifying, it also gives us an opportunity to think really big about how we can radically shift our mindset and the landscape to make sure that people have access to abortion care that they need.
Well, and part of it is the vernacular we use, the way that abortion has been addressed or not addressed in polite company over the years, right? Some years ago, I used to go to Netroots Nation every year. And one year, a friend of mine, a woman named Darcy Berner, was running for Congress from Washington State. And she got up and made a speech. And it got a lot of press because it was so controversial, because she admitted that she had, at one point in her life, gotten an abortion. And she challenged the women. She said, just go with me here. How many of you have had an abortion? And women around the room stood. Now, some women applauded. I think they were applauding their courage. The right-wing press reported on it as, oh, these liberals, they all applauded the people killing babies. Well, not killing babies. It's taking care of themselves. But the fact, and she said, no, don't clap. This is just, I want to make a point. One third of adult women have gotten an abortion. And we don't talk about it in polite company because why? And we need to take the stigma away from women who are taking care of themselves and doing a procedure that is legal. And they used to say something like, well, abortion should be safe and rare. Well, no, we don't need to use those terms. If you're seeking medical care, you don't have to have that qualifier on it. We need to bring this into the 21st century and talk about this as women's health care, which it absolutely is. So there's a problem with our attitudes and the way we talk about it or don't talk about it, isn't there?
Absolutely. I 100% agree with you that abortion care is health care, and it needs to be normalized as a service that people need, have a right to get, and must get, and that we all have a social responsibility to ensure is available to them. There are so many folks out there who acknowledge this, right? Who acknowledge how important this is, who are doing their best to make sure that we can undo what's been done with Dobbs and chart a new path forward. But an important part of that is doing exactly what you're saying, which is normalizing That's right. access to abortion care as something that should not be stigmatized, as something that is part of people's healthcare needs. And that is crucial for making sure that people have access to the lives that they have a right to have access to for whatever reason that they need to have an abortion.
Absolutely. And yet here we are. And I went to see Bruce Springsteen last night. So I've got Bruce on the brain. He has a song called One Step Up. And he's talking about one step up and two steps back. Well, when you it's one thing when you take two steps up and one back, you're at least making a little bit of forward progress. When you take one up and two back, you're losing. And that's what I feel like where we are now. So you have Joe Biden delivering a brilliant State of the Union address last week and looking, as Jamie Raskin referenced, looking at the members of the Supreme Court and basically saying, pardon my French, you fucked up. How dare you? You know, take a look at yourselves. This is not what you're there for. And he called them out. And thank you, President Biden, for that. But now, you know, you have states that are passing laws saying that a fertilized frozen embryo is a, quote, child. It's not a child. It's not a baby. It's not even a fetus at that point. It's a zygote. It's a cell. Why not let's take our frozen embryos and put them in the car with us and we can all drive in the carpool lane?
It's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. And what the Supreme Court has done is unconscionable. What is taking place now with IVF and other decisions around people's health care is just a demonstration of how far folks that are trying to encroach on people's rights are going to take it. We know that when things happen with Dobbs, there were conversations about contraception that were ongoing. This is the next thing, which we see what's happening with IVF. I think one of the key things that we're seeing and that I like to make sure that people recognize is that whether or not they understand or think they care about abortion is fundamentally about freedom And this is fundamentally about the health and safety of our democracy. And so many of the things that are going on are just a demonstration of the shaky ground that we have been on for a very long time, and the ways that the policies and laws that are being enacted are just going to keep spreading in their negative effect on people. And it's only a matter of time before those people who feel like this is not about them, they don't have anything to deal with or think about, it's only a matter of time before they recognize that some of the things that they care about are going to be on the chopping block next, and that they need to step up to make sure that we fight this, right? That we fight the gradual, some of it's gradual, some of it's rapid, right? We need to fight all of it because it's a threat to everyone.
Crystal Littlejohn is our guest. We're talking about the new book, hit stores yesterday, so you can order it and get it now, Fighting Mad, Resisting the End of Roe v. Wade. So France did something that I don't think anybody expected. They put in their constitution a woman's right to bodily autonomy, a woman's right to have an abortion. That was not in my prediction card. Anytime in the near future, France, just to show how backward we are moving. Part two of the book is a section called Never Ending Emergency and Never Ending Fight. Joe Biden spotlighted it at the State of the Union with a couple of women whose stories we had heard, one in Texas who wanted another child. They were trying to have a baby, and she knew, she was told by the doctors that her pregnancy was not viable and it was life-threatening, but the doctors wouldn't perform a DNC. They wouldn't do an abortion because of the law, and they won't in so many places now, unless and until the mother's, the woman's life is in such danger that she may not survive. What year is this? What country is this? This is, it's unconscionable that we're living through this. And that's what this section is about.
Absolutely. It is, what we're seeing is the ways that this decision is preventing people from getting the standard of care. It's preventing people from having access to life-saving care as soon as they need it. And it's also a demonstration of the longstanding importance of fighting, right? Of all we've folks on the ground have had to fight abortion restrictions from even before the Dobbs decision, right? The Dobbs decision was just the latest and most injurious decision around abortion rights. And what this section really does is gathers the voices of folks that demonstrate across domains that people were fighting before the Dobbs decision, and they have to fight even more after the Dobbs decision, because as we see these ripple effects that are taking place across all kinds of different states, there are just so many more people that are being negatively affected by this. And it's a real wake-up call. I hope it's a real wake-up call for people that didn't think that we could be here, right? I hear people talking about often how it feels like, you know, they woke up to a nightmare that many people thought just wouldn't happen, that we couldn't get here. And yet we see this is exactly where we are. But also we see, as Fighting Mad demonstrates, that even as this is where we are, there are healthcare professionals banding together, urging each other to make sure that they are thinking about the rights and needs of their patients. There are reproductive organizations, reproductive justice organizations, and other organizations that are making sure that people have access to legal resources, whether that's bail, whether that's information on what they can expect if they face criminalization for their pregnancies, right? There are so many different ways that people are trying to make sure that their work is filling in the holes and the gaps in the support that people need, and that Dobbs has in some cases has revealed, and in other cases has created, right? Has created these new barriers. And the section on the never ending emergency and never ending fight just really does a wonderful job of showcasing how, even amid it all, and one of the key things that I want to point out is that the book is really focusing on what was taking place in the immediate aftermath of the Dobbs decision, right? So there's so many moving parts, there's so much stuff going on, and yet you also had so many people that knew even before the Dobbs decision came down, we must do something. Ricky and I were part of that group that as soon as, you know, we heard about the leak from the Supreme Court, we knew we have to do something, right? Yeah. We felt compelled to do something. And that gives me hope, right? That even as there, it is a never ending emergency, that there are folks out there that are fighting and that are going to continue to fight. So that some of these things that are happening can hopefully not happen for other people in the future.
Right. Well, that brings us to part three of the book, which is Strategic Action for Securing Access. Now, this is us stepping up and fighting mad. And so I remember very vividly January 21st, 2017. It was the day after the failed former guy. I wish I could echo everything that Chantel Brown said. But that guy was inaugurated, unthinkably. The next day was the Women's March. And millions of women, not only in this country, but around the world, took to the streets wearing the pussy hats and carrying signs. And it wasn't only women. Men were with us. It was a magical day. It was the largest march in the world. We need that again now, because we need to put our voices together and take action together and make a statement as loud as we did on January 21st, 2017. I think we just need someone to step up and do it. But we need a show of force like that before November 5th of this year.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that gave me hope when working on this book, and I'm sure is also the case for Ricky, was the idea that even though we haven't had such a massive organization of folks as we did on that day, what we see in Fighting Mad is that there are people that are doing things, right? Mm-hmm. There are legislators that are doing things. They're working with their constituents. We have folks from talking about what happened in Kansas in the book. We have people talking about information campaigns that are taking place in Kentucky, right? And so there are so many people who are doing work that just might not be visible. And it's not visible on the main stage, as we've seen with some of these demonstrations in the past. But it doesn't mean that the work isn't getting done. And as a sociologist, that was one of the things that was really key for me, was that I didn't want this work that the contributors are doing to get lost to history, right? Uh-huh. I didn't want it to get erased in the immediate aftermath of the Dobbs decision, with so much information coming at us from all kinds of different directions. We know that so many different people have been affected by the Dobbs decision, yep. But it was really important to me to be able to do something so that for our social memory, people had access to the knowledge, that they had access to knowing that even with everything going on, there are people in Oklahoma, there are people in Kentucky, there are people in Kansas, there are people in so many places that folks may not even think about as being centers for abortion activism, that are fighting desperately to try and get the folks in their communities access to abortion care, whether that's supporting them with travel, et cetera.
Of course. And remember that even when Roe was still the law of the land, when abortion was safe and legal, there was a need for clinic escorts to walk women from their cars into the clinic because of the harassment from religious nuts, mostly, who would try to stop them and show them pictures of aborted fetuses and just horrible, the machinations they would go through to try to prevent a woman from taking care of herself as she knows best how to do. And we saw the murder of Dr. Tiller, an abortion provider, because some asshole on Fox Not News called him a baby killer and ratcheted people up. Well, now you have a guy who's running for president as the former occupant of the Oval Office, who also speaks in that kind of hyperbole and and incites people to violence. And that's a fear for this year, not only around abortion rights, but around life. I mean, hopefully reelecting our president. Now, you know, we've got a went to this event with Jamie Raskin on Sunday, and they had Biden-Harris yard signs. So we took a couple of them. But now we're living in a Phoenix suburb. When, you know, I don't know, we just moved here from Florida because we escaped there. Kind of nervous that we don't know the neighbors, really. But we placed it strategically so the Ring camera will see if anybody takes it or defaces it. And so far, it's been up there a few days, and it's all well and good. We all need to get out of our comfort zones and stand up and make a stand for what's right for our kids' future. I mean, I left my daughter in Florida, and it scares me. So, Crystal, we go back. We covered the first three sections. The next few are all about fighting at the frontiers of criminalization, protecting abortion access in the face of fascism, which we talked about, resisting religious tyranny. That's a big one. And this, you know, this Christian nationalist movement is really frightening. You have Donald Trump saying that, you know, there are people that if they're not going to practice the right religion, well, what's the right religion? You know, this is not America. We need to stand up and not be shy about saying what we believe in. Otherwise, we're not going to get the message out there accurately, are we?
Absolutely. And it's so important to make sure that people understand and grapple with what religious freedom actually means in this context. I think that because of Christian supremacy, there can be this understanding that the religious stance on abortion is an anti-abortion stance. And we know that that's just not true. We have contributors in this volume that demonstrate that in order to truly experience religious freedom, we can't allow certain religious beliefs and people that harbor certain religious beliefs to be the people that dictate what anybody else's religious practices should be.
Well, Judaism,
that's
just
crucial.
Just for an example, Judaism always puts the mother's health as paramount. A fetus is not considered a human life until the moment of its birth, which sounds like common sense to me. And abortion is always, it's medical care. The woman's health is paramount. There's no question. And so why someone else's religion would take precedent over my own, not that I'm practicing, but just as an example, mm-hmm. How dare you? You know, you have no right to tell me. But Donald Trump also says we don't want the people with the wrong religion. So there's a lot of work we have to do to turn around attitudes. Even putting Dobbs aside, we'd still have that work to do, but now it's just magnified. The final section is envisioning the future. So how do you envision the future, Crystal Littlejohn?
I envision the future very hopefully. I think that one of the things that gives me faith and that gives me hope is knowing that even as the courts have had a long-standing history of not putting its citizens first, right, of not only taking away rights, but also actively seeking to violate the rights of people in this country, that there have also always been activists that are fighting for a better future. And one of the things that this book really demonstrates for me is the importance of doing whatever anybody can do. The folks in this volume showcase just so many different ways to get involved, right? It can, and you don't have to have previously been involved with the movement to get involved now, right? It can be just changing, as we're talking about, trying to normalize talking about abortion. It could be challenging people who are in your community and in your circle who are making inaccurate claims about abortion. Yep. Right? There are multiple ways that people can get involved. It can be donating to an abortion fund.
But I need to interrupt 1 second. Inaccurate claims. This is an epidemic right now because every time the Republicans have a hearing or any chance they get to interject a prime piece of
bullshit,
they do it. They say The Democrats, they say abortion on demand up until and after the time of birth. Let's be very clear. That does not happen. If it is on the books, the reason it's on the books is to protect a woman who might have a catastrophic rupture or something in the ninth month, where the only way to save her life is to take that fetus out of the womb. It doesn't happen except in the rarest occasions. But to protect women, that's why it's on the books. But they blow it up as, oh, Democrats, they just want to kill babies. They do it after the baby's born. That is bullshit, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's bullshit. We know that there are lies. We know that people are peddling lies and actively seeking to convince other people of things that are just outright bullshit, as you said. And everybody has a role to play in pushing back against that, right? Please. As I said, you don't have to have any involvement with the movement previously to check people when they are spreading lies, when they are repeating bullshit that they've heard, and when people say that,
your responsibility is to counter it in the moment. I've seen too many, you know, media people, pundits, who they're trying to be polite. So that doesn't happen. No, you need to be forceful. That does not happen. That is nonsense. And I've seen a few people get angry. Like when I hear that, I throw stuff at the TV. I get so mad because there are people out there, you know, the poorly educated that Trump loves, who just don't know. And we need to inform them. It doesn't happen. You know,
they live
off of lies. So, yeah, I'm sorry. That's one of the worst things. I hear it all the time. They all do it. And steam comes out of my ears.
And no. And there are people that are committed to being polite. I'm committed to the truth. And I think that all of us have an obligation to be committed to the truth, because we know how dangerous it is to allow people to spread lies. And we know very well how detrimental the Dobbs decision has been for people's health and for people's very, very lives. And it's crucial. It's crucial that anybody that can intervenes in whatever way they possibly can.
Without a doubt. Crystal Littlejohn, the book is wonderful. Can you tell just briefly, we've only got like a minute or two left, tell us some of the people who are featured in the various essays that you have included in the book.
We have so many wonderful contributors. We have Sheila Desai, who talks about the experiences of Asian American women in the United States. We have Loretta Ross, who is just foundational to the reproductive justice movement and gives us a better future, gives us a vision for a better future with reproductive justice at its core. We have Cynthia Gutierrez, who is an abortion doula and talks about her experience as an abortion doula, helping people get the access to care that they need. We have Koya White Hat Artichoker, a longtime activist who gives us indigenous reproductive justice vision to really make sure that we're centering the needs and rights of the communities that are most marginalized. And so there's those folks and so many more that are in this volume and giving us hope for the future.
Great. Well, the book is a collection of essays from these brilliant people who are saying things that we not only all need to know, but to familiarize ourselves with, so that when we talk to other people, you know, we have all the arguments. I mean, we know them intrinsically. We understand. We feel it. But you have a lot of great information in here. And because they're essays, you know, you could pick up and just read one essay at a time. You don't have to sit and read through the whole book. It's a great resource. Great bathroom reading. Leave it in there so the men can read it too, because, you know, they're in this with us as well.
Right? Absolutely. Absolutely.
Crystal Littlejohn, A Fighting Mad. The book is available now. Go pick it up. We are in this together. And if not for ourselves, for our kids, for our daughters, 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 and the men who may impregnate them too. Right? Crystal, thank you so much. It was great to talk to you. I really appreciate it. And congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate being here. Thank you, everybody.
Take care. Bye-bye. You know, this is one of the most important issues of our lifetimes. Again, I'm not going to be around a whole lot longer, probably. You know, it's a reality. But I have a daughter. I don't want her living a life where some asshole men are telling her what she can and can't do with her body. It talk about two giant steps backwards. That's where we are. All right. Tomorrow's Thursday. Howie Klein will be here. Joining us will be Stephen Fulop. He is the current mayor of Jersey City. He's going to be running for governor of New Jersey. That election is next November 2025. A lot of stuff to talk with him about. And then on Friday, of course, Marcy Wheeler. Oh, yeah, we had that hearing today and a lot more happening this week. Each week is like a month, you know? So anyway, with that, we are done. Thank you for listening. I'm going to go take a nap because I'm still flying from last night. See Bruce if you can, you know, just do. It's from someone who's seen thousands of concerts in her life. There's nothing like a Springsteen concert. All right. With that, we're done. Thank you for listening, everybody. I'll see you tomorrow with Howie Klein and the mayor of Jersey City. Have a great night. Peace out.